Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Ed Horley with my co-host, Scott Hoag. Tom is out on assignment today, so, you know, hey, we wanted to sort of let the audience know that sponsorship's still available. If you're really interested in that, you can go hit packetpushers.net/sponsorship for details. Today, we're going to be talking about IPv6 and public cloud with our guest, Ivan Pepinyak from ipspace.net. And, you know, Ivan, welcome to the show. We're really thrilled to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure having a chat with you.
Well, it's always great to have you on any show. I know you've been on the Packet Pushers just a ton of times, and so folks should be really familiar with you and that. But I've had the good fortune of knowing you for quite a few years and getting a chance to come out and visit you in your native country and get a chance to be hosted out there. That was fantastic. Wonderful. So thank you for that.
You're most welcome.
Yeah. Well,
you know, you can always come back.
Oh, that means a lot to me. I appreciate that. We wanted to talk about IPv6 and cloud, and maybe just cloud networking in general, in addition to V6. V6 is supported in a bunch of public clouds, but we wanted to get a chance to sort of talk about it. And, you know, at this point in time, probably the number one and number two cloud providers on the public cloud side is AWS and Azure. I mean, maybe Tencent is getting up there, or Alibaba in terms of worldwide footprint, but AWS and Azure, certainly here in the US, are probably number one and number two by a pretty big stretch. And both have IPv6 available. And we didn't know if you've been working around sort of cloud networking and that space for a long time and talking about it and teaching about it. And you sort of wanted to get your thoughts around sort of capabilities, limitations, and maybe just cloud networking in general about where both of those public cloud providers sort of fit. So maybe that's a better sort of starting point, is sort of the general landscape about where AWS and Azure fit in the public cloud networking space.
Well, you know, if you look at them from a generic perspective, they more or less do the same thing, because there is more or less one right way of doing things. They both, as you know, offer virtual networks, subnets, load balancing, security groups, direct connection back to your on-premises data center with BGP and IPsec, because that's the only thing that makes sense contrary to what some vendors would love you believe. And so it's more or less the same thing. The only difference are the details, like, do we have one subnet per availability zone, or do we have one subnet stretched across availability zones? And of course, people hate that you need three subnets for three availability zones with AWS.
Right.
And they hate it even more when they have to figure out the details of zonal resources with Azure. So,
right. So even though you get the same subnet across three different availability sets in Azure, the reality is that you have some odd, you know, default gateway components that they're handling behind the scenes for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like stretching a subnet across two data centers. When one of them fails, what happens with the whole thing?
Right.
Same thing here.
Right. And it's all the adjacencies, what actually gets updated in your tables, what's the failed state, and what resources can or can't communicate to each other becomes a little bit more complex to try and figure out, right?
Yeah. And I also, when I was doing an update for on Azure load balancing, figured out another thing. Actually, the zone failure is the best thing that can happen to you. Zone performance problems are the worst thing.
Because you get a big delta, right, between...
Yeah, and then you deploy, you know, each tier of your application in all availability zones. You're just using the availability set, and it's all over the place. And so every single request from the user will, by definition, because bad things happen, Murphy's Law, will hit at least one of the bad apples in the affected availability zone. So the whole thing will be slow.
Right. You'll get very different performance behaviors in the same availability, availability set. Yeah, it becomes a really big challenge of trying to debug and figure out what's going on. So you're better off just having that zone just fail outright, right?
Yeah, exactly. If only things would fail.
Just please go down.
Yeah, just fail cleanly, please.
Yeah, and this is true for V4 or V6. There's no difference in terms of that behavior set.
Yeah, there's no difference there.
Yeah. And it's I think one of the interesting differences too, and maybe we can noodle around this too, is just the difference in terms of how AWS and Azure sort of treats layer two versus layer three and learning and how that functions. It is structurally different between the two. It doesn't look any different for maybe a host operating system in terms of its behavior, or any application developer. But for a networking person, this is definitely something that looks a little odd, right? In terms of the distinction between the feature sets.
Well, you see, they both were smart enough to realize something that the enterprise networking vendors are desperately not admitting, which is that layer 2 sucks. So there is no broadcast, there is no flooding, there's no unknown unicast in either one of them.
Right.
They effectively do unicast forwarding based on deterministic destination addresses. Now, the real question is, what is the destination address? And Azure has a clean picture where the destination address is the IP address.
Yes.
So they effectively have a router connected to your VM, and the router has sort of unnumbered interfaces, if you wish. And when you ARP for something or ND for something, obviously you always get back the same router MAC address. And AWS started that way, and I don't think I have those traces anywhere, but when I was first doing tests with AWS, they did exactly the same thing.
That was a classic. Like, that was classic mode, right?
VPC.
VPC? Okay.
VPC. And I was like, cool, they got it right. And then years later, someone told me, well, no, it doesn't work that way. And I repeated that test, those tests, and it was like, oh, shit, it doesn't. True. The real problem is, you know, that for whatever reason, AWS is very adamant that you cannot have static routes for more specific prefixes than your CIDR block. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what the technical limitation is, because with Azure, as you know, with user-defined routes, you can just point the static route for the next subnet to some appliance, and the packets go through the appliance. And if the appliance is in different VPC, they're even happier because then they charge you more. But
right.
With AWS, you can't do that. So with AWS, there is no intra-VPC routing. Every packet goes direct to destination.
Yep.
And of course, then you have the problem of how do I insert my beautiful, handcrafted Snowflake network appliances, overpriced network appliances, into this model? So how do I insert them into the forwarding path? And the only way they could make that work was to say, oh, wait, you know what? Within the subnet, we will route on the MAC addresses. And then you can have static routes on your hosts, and because the next hop has a MAC address, we're good.
But you have to put it on every host, so that's the whole concept of the route tables, right? So the route tables is an aggregation of putting those entries on every host that's required within that subnet,
and
right?
And all the hosts have to be in the same subnet, because obviously MAC addresses don't work across subnets.
Exactly.
Trust me, I tried.
Well, and that's also a difference with Azure, because Azure can have repeated MAC addresses within host sets, right? Because of that behavior, that layer 3 hop behavior.
Yeah, of course,
right?
Because it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
And with AWS, in theory, you could have the same MAC address on different hosts in different subnets, but I hope the orchestration system stops you from doing that stupidity.
The new technique that's just come out at AWS reInvent is the gateway load balancer that would direct, you know, traffic statefully from different VPCs, have a gateway load balancer, you know, ENI attachment, and then force the traffic through some middle box or firewalling service or proxy or something like that, shared across multiple VPCs. So Watch the new sessions that they've recorded on gateway load balancer the past few weeks.
The gateway load balancer, which is everyone else calls a router.
No, it's more than that. You know, the real trick is that if you look at how both of them do forwarding inside the cloud, it's always ingress routing. You cannot do hairpinning or anything else. And that's why you can't do transitive VPC peering, for example. Anytime you want to do any hairpinning or anything transitive, the packet has to go out of the transport network to an appliance and then back. And of course, that appliance can be your VM or it can be the transit gateway.
Right.
The Transit Gateway is really a scale-out appliance with Anycast IP addresses. Mm-hmm. And the packet leaves the transport network, gets routed above it in an appliance, and sent back. And what they did now is they just added tunnels from that appliance to your appliance so that, you know, like in the good old days with, what was that web caching protocol called?
WCCP version 2.
Reinvented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And they use Geneve because they need metadata. Mm-hmm. They have to tell the appliance in every packet, oh, this packet is coming from this VPC, so treat it accordingly. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all the Geneve fanboys are now claiming how this is the clear win for Geneve and no one else is using it apart from NSX, but it doesn't matter. AWS is now using it. Hooray.
Yes.
Yeah. So what you're saying is WCCP V2 per VRF.
Yeah,
with tunnels.
With tunnels.
Don't get me started on more tunneling.
Yeah. Well, you see, as we discussed when we started, before we started recording, every time you want to have multiple routing domains on the same infrastructure or multiple address spaces on the same infrastructure, you have to hide some details. Mm-hmm. Now, this is virtual circuits, if you wish, or it is MPLS labels, which is effectively virtual circuits, yep. Or it is tunnels, which is effectively virtual circuits.
Yeah.
There is no way around that.
The overlay of overlays, right? So mm-hmm. It's...
every time you want to hide something, you have to encapsulate it into something else. I mean, right. There's laws of physics. <It's>
laws of abstraction. Abstract the abstractor. Yeah, no, I mean, it's good for folks to understand this because V6 has to live inside of all of the same constraints that V4 is living in inside these public clouds. There's no difference in terms of what's going to happen there. And there will be no difference in terms of any of the feature sets as they add V6 to more and more parity with V4, because it's mm-hmm. not in parity today on either platform. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to continue to address the same sort of issues, and you'll have the same sort of, you know, route related issues and performance related issues that we outlined earlier. I mean, that's not going to change.
But honestly, I shouldn't ask this question, but do we really care about full feature parity?
I don't know. I really don't know about that one. It would be a nice to have. I don't think it's a must have, in my opinion. I think there's a set of features that are going to be required, and I think AWS is going to, you know, is pretty V6. You know, has been adding more and more V6 features for sure. Mm-hmm. I think, and maybe Scott can talk about this because I know you were listening on reInvent on the recent reInvent stuff, and maybe you can talk a little bit about some of the new ones that came out. But
The networking team at AWS has been really busy this last year. About a year ago, you know, they announced inter-region VPC peering for IPv6, so you could do that. And then VGW support for IPv6 came this year. And so you can have, it uses IPv4 for the connection, but then inside of that tunnel, you can have dual protocol within the tunnel. And so site-to-site VPN now supports V6, and you have with transit gateway attachments, and you set the tunnel option like inside IP being IPv6.
Right.
Oh, wait, right there. This doesn't sound right.
What do you mean?
Site-to-site VPN supports IPv6. It's V4 in the outer.
Yeah, but isn't Virtual Gateway using IPsec to back to your on-premises VPN concentrator?
Your CGW, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and doesn't IPsec run the same protocol on the unencrypted and encrypted side, or did that change while I wasn't looking?
The connection is made to the VGW endpoints are still V4 addresses.
No, but theoretically, you know, in the good old days when I still cared about IPsec, mm-hmm. it was 6/6 or 4/4. And now you're saying they're doing 6/4, which, I mean, theoretically, yeah, okay, maybe. But is it even allowed by the standard? And is it implemented by other vendors on the other side?
Well, it's definitely implemented by others because you can do that as a VPN head-end termination on other platforms. I mean, that's supported today for doing 6.74.
But with pure IPsec or with tunneling inside IPsec?
No, pure IPsec. Yeah, I'm almost positive on that one.
We have to do GRE tunnel.
It's GRE.
You're right. It's GRE.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have the beautiful stack of V6 over GRE, over IPsec, over IPv4.
Yeah, you've got a whole sandwich.
Great. Okay.
You got a full sandwich.
Yeah.
Now I'm good.
Yeah. And you like small MTUs, so, and TCP/MFS. that's what you get. And then network load balancer supports V6 now. So you just have to set the IP address to be dual stack, just like you do with an ALB. And then you have Elastic Container Service, ECS supports V6, and Fargate when it's in AWS VPC mode. And that works on, V6 enabled VPCs. So you have to have a V6 enabled VPC to do that ECS.
Is that for new VPCs? Is that on by default that V6 is turned on now, or is that
no?
Yeah,
no,
so you have to go. You have to go into that process.
Enable V6, then you get
right.
By default, you would get a /56 from AWS's address space. The thing that came about earlier this year, was bring your own IPv6. So when you go to configure your VPC, you say bring your own IPv6, and then you can define your prefix that you're bringing
right
to the table. And then AWS Shield supports IPv6. And then other cool features the networking team at AWS has come about with is VPC traffic mirroring, kind of like a tap or a span port. You can do DNS query logs, the AWS network firewall, Transit Gateway Connect, which is like SD-WAN in the cloud. And then the AWS VPC Reachability Analyzer is kind of cool. So a variety of features, and then network monitoring, network management. So a few cool things.
Yeah, I mean, and maybe to get back to, Ivan's original point was, do we need a one-for-one parity? And I don't know. Maybe we should have a little bit of a chat about that and see where our thoughts are around it. But
Ed, you wrote a great article about feature parity versus functional parity.
Right.
So in AWS, you have an IGW, which performs the NAT44 function, traffic leaving your VPC. IPv6, we don't need the NAT function. So what we have is we have an egress-only internet gateway for IPv6 communication that's going out.
Right.
It performs that same outbound, function, but doesn't perform the NAT.
Right. Although there's some argument that could be made that maybe they should do, this is going to be heresy now, do NAT66 and get it to an AWS address space if you want to somehow, only use their address space for maybe internet connectivity for any given reason. Although you could just apply portions of your VPC using their address space, I imagine, and just use, the VGW and the gateway to be able to.
That would be interesting.
Just make it that much more complex, right? But
can you do that at all?
So here's the challenge that I see is that the operational model for many people in V4 looks like that, and they don't have a matching model in V6. And so there's a lot of people that just push back and they're like, this doesn't match my operational model, doesn't match my security context about how I think about things. And it's just weird for me to have a portion of network that just the global unicast address can just go outbound and do its thing. I don't think that same way with the existing infrastructure that I already run and maintain. I use a NAT gateway to sort of quote unquote hide, but also to use it as an overload capability for the number of resources I have. Now that's not a concern in V6, but the operational model is different. Mm-hmm. So there's an argument to be made there.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking. It was a few months back when I was reading the V6 documentation for AWS, but it was like, you can use your own IPv6 address if you wish, but then you can't have internet connectivity from that VPC.
Right. You can only get across and back to your net because you own that address block range, right? So it's coming back and routing to you. But how do you give them internet access?
One distinction is with IPv4, you can have an elastic IP, an address that's non-changing. You can put into DNS, Route 53, or what have you for a service. With IPv6, you don't have elastic IPs. Now you have global address space, and you can go into an EC2 instance and assign a, you know, out of your /64 that's been assigned to your subnet, you can add another IPv6 address that's seemingly static and non-changing because it's using the synthetic DHCPv6 service on each subnet. So that could change, and you don't want to have, you know, if you wanted a static non-changing address, you can do that on the EC2 instance. So that's a functional, you know, a difference between V4 and V6 elastic IPs, but do you need elastic IPs for IPv6? That's the question.
Right.
Like, you know, the EC2 instance metadata, you know, you get data, you can read from the 169.254, 169.254, you know, /latest/meta-data. You can read data from the EC2 instance back. You don't have that functionality over IPv6, but if you can do it over IPv4, is that good enough? You know, so.
And that's an interesting one because that forces you to be dual stacked inside the VPC.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
You can't run a V6 only VPC today.
Yeah.
You just can just not use IPv4 or not use DNS resolve to any A record, or you could put in NACLs to block V4. So you could, if you wanted to, it has IPv4, but IPv4 is not the transport used.
Yeah, it's not the data. It's not the data. Yeah, it's not the data plane side, but you're still going to need it for the management and control plane side for what's going on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway.
We went down a rat hole.
No, I was just thinking that, you know, both Azure and AWS use DHCPv6. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want you to mess around with addresses that they have to support in their forwarding tables. Mm-hmm. So it's all orchestration system driven. And well, you can try Slack. Good luck with that. No, it will not work. Mm-hmm. So elastic IP addresses are a non-issue because you can just configure any IPv6 address you wish when you start the VM and off you go.
Mm-hmm. Right, and it'll read it in, it'll use that and then load it in the forwarding table for what's required.
Yeah, so, well, it will load in the forwarding table. You will get it into DHCPv6 reply if you care to run DHCP, so no Android in AWS cloud.
Yeah, that's one of the structural issues that I don't know if they put a shim in that fakes it out, that does like a DHCPv6 to Slack local RA fake out or something like that. I don't know. I've never played with that portion of it.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. The other thing is, I know in AWS, the routing advertisements come out every 10 seconds because it has to keep that the state of that forwarding substrate updated and knowing which addresses on which instances have which MAC addresses and keep that you know, binding state fresh. And so RAs come out every 10 seconds. I don't know in Azure how quickly RAs come out, but they need to come out more frequently than it might on a traditional enterprise network because it's trying to keep that state fresh.
No, there is no state. I mean,
Or the binding of link layer addresses to instances.
No,
but
because because you can only change that binding through the orchestration system.
Yeah,
you can do whatever you wish on your instance. If the change is not made through the orchestration system at the same time, your MAC or IP address will just be ignored.
Yeah, yes, that's true.
So I don't know why they are sending RAs at such a short interval.
Yeah, it's probably
there must be something else going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if they're using that for just discovering net new request for address space or something like that off a host that might have a new set of behavior.
It's RAs, so
or to speed cloud init when an instance instantiates.
Right.
Yeah.
If it's not sending out the RS, then it needs to get the RA faster than it would otherwise.
That might, you know what? You don't have a usable address until you get RA, and the RA is telling you that, oh my God, contrary to religious wisdom, we are using DHCPv6 here. So you better use that one to get your real IPv6 address, and then you can connect to somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, because the host boot up process, it gets a link local, it does duplicate address detection on the link local, then it sends the RS sourced from its link local. But if it doesn't have that, I always say in IPv6, you need an address to get an address, and then you start with that link local address.
Right.
And that's part of the bootstrap process. Yeah. So if you can't get to that point, you need the RAs to come out more frequently.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Well, we noodled through that one.
Good job.
Well, I mean, I guess this belabors the original point, which is V6 somehow more critical or less critical for public clouds? Because as we just talked through from a functional basis, you need enough functionality out of V6 in order to participate on the V6 internet if that's what you need, or for V6 running for any internal services. There's a couple of interesting use cases. I think that V6 becomes really sort of cool for public cloud. Like you can use it as your initial maybe V6 location to get something started for your company and then not have to be doing anything on-prem within your data center until you're ready to be able to sort of interface or exchange, you know, routes with that public cloud around V6. And so you can sort of grow your way into V6 by learning inside of AWS first. I don't know. I mean, what's your thoughts around that in terms of where the cloud providers are at? And obviously they're going to have, a big issue with just sort of expanding and growing themselves. So they're going to need V6 for other reasons, unless you feel like V4 can just be infinite for them in terms of what they're doing today.
Now, honestly, within VPC, why do you care?
Yeah, that's probably true from an isolation standpoint. I was sort of talking about their underlay versus, necessarily the abstraction they're providing for customers.
Oh, but for the underlay, who cares? Because that is isolated from the outside world anyway.
Right. They run into
the internal underlay.
Right, right. Do they run into some, in terms of what they're providing to customers, though, they have a finite resource they can provide to customers in terms of what they provide for their abstraction. It's not for the VPC, but for getting out on the public internet, which is part of the point.
I understand. Well, you see, even if the public internet would, by some miracle, turn off IPv4 tomorrow morning and everything would be IPv6, you could still keep running IPv4 inside your VPC as long as you're only using web applications. You just put an application load balancer in front of it, bam, problem solved. The real problem is if you have non-web applications and you want to have load balancer, because then you need the network load balancer.
Yeah.
And the network load balancer is a layer 4 proxy, and it cannot terminate one session and open a different session on a different address family. So you have to pull the same address family through and through. And that in that case, you do care if you have V6 on the outside, you have to have V6 on the inside.
Right.
But yeah. If I would be a web property, and I mean, this sounds heretic on this show, but if I would be a web property, would I want to have a dual stack network inside my VPC? Probably not.
Yeah, you probably just do it at the edge. I mean,
exactly.
We talk about this all the time. We're pragmatic about V6. We're not religious about V6. We're pragmatic about V6. And I feel like, if you need V6, turn it on at the edge services where it makes sense. Mm-hmm. And, your CDN, it's like CloudFront. Get CloudFront going for you to get.
Well, I have CloudFront for that.
Yeah.
I have V6 enabled. I haven't configured V6 anywhere.
Right. Yeah.
And it's on by default.
and that's a great way to go for many folks. Mm-hmm. Push that problem, outsource your problems, right? So
call your CDN provider. Call Cloudflare.
Call Cloudflare. If you're on AWS and you just want to turn on CloudFront, you can do that too. I mean, there's lots of options in terms of that particular category of solving your problems. I think it's sort of interesting because we're starting to see, at least, for the community that we talk to and sort of, some of the challenges the cloud providers have is how much V4 address space they can actually acquire and continue to acquire at the rate and pace they are, given how much address space they have to hand out for services that are operating. And so that's becoming a bit of a driver around, like, hey, we'd like you to really turn on more V6 services and start moving that direction, because the V4 is becoming a harder and harder resource for them to manage, especially clean V4 address space. So I should
add,
put that
honestly,
caveat.
You know those numbers better than I do, but how much does an IPv4 address cost these days if you buy in like /16 chunks or bigger?
Yeah, probably in the that larger chunks, probably the, I don't know, what was it last, Scott? We were seeing $25 to $29 an IP for IPv4. Yeah.
It goes up about 20% every year.
Yeah. That's not the issue for them, because I mean, we've done the math on this. So they go out and buy this address for $29. Let's say even $30, make it easy, right? So they buy this address for $30, they own it for forever,
they
effectively.
They earn that from me on egress traffic in a month.
You know, they earn that just leasing you the address for 6 months, all right? Yeah. They pay for that address in 6 months of you borrowing it. All right.
Yeah.
So it's not a dollar. I mean, I think they did some back of the envelope math that said like AWS has already spent $3.3 billion on V4 address space or something like crazy like that.
Okay.
But that's a drop in the bucket compared to their monthly revenue, right? So sort of like the V4 address space really isn't a cost model problem. It's really a how many are we handing out how quickly problem.
Yeah. You buy an address, then you lease it to someone because it's an elastic IP. you make the money back in 6 months. You still own the asset, which you could sell or transfer at a later date if you see
or
more
at least
workloads
to someone else
moving
if they,
to V6.
Right.
Or, you've blocked out. You now have a competitive advantage and removed a barrier to the scale of your infrastructure, and it's covered its cost. And its payback period is like, what, 6 months?
Yeah. 4 to 6 months is typical for their payback period. So for those of you that are thinking that they're spending too much money on V4 address space, that is a lie. Demand more money for your V4 address space. But I agree with you that it's not really an issue of cost. I think it's more of an issue of how they're managing and how much clean address space can you actually get. I think that's the harder thing that's going on discussion-wise right now is the address space
you know,
they can't get.
If the clean address, you're coming from a capitalist country, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, if the clean address space would be so rare, the price wouldn't be $30.
Yeah. See, it's the holidays. So if you want to understand this process, you watch Trading Places, the movie, and they talk about the price of orange juice futures in the movie.
And yeah, exactly.
IPv4, just replace orange juice for IPv4 address space. And the movie is still relevant today, decades later.
Too funny. Well, and they are solving some of this problem. I mean, the cloud providers are actively, there's a bunch of, folks on the consideration side of saying like, okay, we've run out of RFC 1918 space. How do we start expanding into VPCs AWS or in Azure when we don't have address space to use to do that?
Yes.
Can I tell you a funny story?
Oh, sure.
A multinational that shall remain unnamed, where a dozen different departments just went into one of the public clouds with a credit card and just used the default CIDR block that they get, each one of them. And then the networking team was asked to connect all of them to some common services.
There's a lot of NAT gateway installations going on.
Yeah. Well, no, the problem is that you can't do that at all.
Yeah.
Because you can't. AWS even allows you to peer two VPCs with overlapping address space. Azure doesn't.
Yes. Yeah. One of the interesting sessions at this year's AWS reInvent, which was virtual, is a session by Madhura Kale, scaling your networks with IPv6. The session is Net 209, but she shows a really cool example where you use IPv6 through a transit gateway to attach two VPCs with overlapping IPv4 address space. You can use V6 as the global unique address space.
And 4 to 6 proxies at the edge are
Yes.
Than the VPC. So in VPC, you're running an appliance that, that's the solution for my customer.
Yeah. So, I mean, but yeah, customers are desperate. You'll also see, you know, many AWS, you know, videos talking about using, you know, 100.64/10, the V4, V6 transition space for service providers, but they'll use that in the cloud as that extra RFC 1918 address space kind of.
Extension.
You'll see examples like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You'll see Netflix talking about how they've done that. And I'm like, hey, if you need a globally unique address space that doesn't overlap with anything else, try IPv6 for a change. Yeah. But it just shows how desperate organizations are to try and find non-overlapping address space for cloud infrastructure.
Yeah, it is a challenge for many of the bigger companies where they've allocated so much address space out of the RFC 1918 for their existing mm-hmm. environment. Although I guess if you're turning down that much data center, then you should be able to recover lots of address space too.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You never turn anything off.
Never turn anything off. Never, nothing ever goes away.
Nope.
Well, I mean, what's your thoughts around, you know, now, near future cloud providers? What do you think there's going to be anything unique around V4 or V6, you know, that sort of helps them expand their business model and what they're up to? I mean, it seems like networking is still the constraint, costs the most thing out of all the cloud models, right? You can sort of elastically control CPU and memory and how many GPUs you have attached, but networking, you can't dial up that you want to sip through a straw and only pay for a certain amount of bits. You're really, you know, they pretty much have the same sort of network performance internally within their infrastructure, and you get to pay for it nonstop all the time, right? You think that's something that the cloud providers are going to address, or you think that that's going to be with us forever because that's just inherent about how networking actually works within data center infrastructure?
Let's turn it around. Why would they be interested in helping you spend less?
Well, you know, I mean, the argument can be made that if you feel like you're being, you know, raked over the coals, that you're going to look for alternative ways to sort of avoid that pain.
Yeah, that happens so often, right?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess the real question is, I mean, what did Andy Jassy got up and said, look, only, you know, 4 or 5% of the overall spend on IT really goes to public cloud services. So don't stop talking about, you know, us starving the market out of dollars about what needs to happen. People spend billions and billions and billions and trillions on still our existing data centers and rolling your own and doing all that sort of work. So, you know, it's while everyone talks about massive cloud adoption, the reality is it's a very small portion of the overall market spend, right?
Yeah, and there's still a lot of server hugging.
Yeah, a lot of server hugging still going on. So yeah. I guess the objection is how do they get more people to adopt? Well, that's one of the ways, right? Is that they make that more affordable because it's pretty astronomical, the pricing to get, you know, data egressing out of a network, right? And you highlighted that earlier in terms of inter VPC traffic and certainly inter region traffic, right? And the costs that are associated with, you know, VPC to VPC inter region and how some of that plays out and you know, just pure internet access costs and things like that.
But, you know, if you track what's going on, and Corey Queen is doing that every now and then, has great fun with that. Effectively, the egress pricing is slowly going down, but not as fast as it could. And everyone, you know, is sort of sticking around to the same pricing. There is not much difference between any two public cloud providers. I was told Oracle is a bit cheaper. So maybe, you know, for my business, because it's a little bit of CPU and most of the spend is people downloading videos, it might be more effective to go to Oracle, but just, you know, the whole migration thing, it would cost me more than what I'm paying in a year. So why bother?
Mm. Right. Well, we'll have to see what sort of external pressures in the industry sort of force or don't force those sets of behaviors. But I think it is one of the few things that, you know, from an elastic costing of a standpoint, you don't get a lot of control or say over, but I don't know if that's going to change because
you know, if you really want to do some crazy stuff and make your bean counters happy, why don't you install an HTTP proxy on your own, and then you manage the egress bandwidth on your own, and you know, bean counters are happy and the customers are screaming.
Well, I mean, it's, and the other part of it is it better to out, I guess the argument is it better to outsource that network related cost to whatever CDN service you're going to go ahead and take care of them, let them distribute it that way. And then you're paying for that network cost across, you know, all the customer base versus just what you have to deal with within your own public cloud. So it's the other way to think about it.
In the end, you will pay someone.
Yeah, you're going to pay someone, but
and you have to, effectively, you have to decide, is the traffic going out of public cloud, CDN, whatever, worth what you're paying for? And if it's not worth what you're paying for it, then obviously you are doing something wrong with your business.
Right. Yeah, that's a fundamental business problem, not necessarily a network problem. Yeah, I agree. That makes a lot of sense. Well, I mean, maybe the next thing is, you know, what should our listeners be thinking about in terms of cloud networking? You know, V4, V6, regardless. I mean, what's the considerations when you're going through and you're sort of engaging and chatting with your customer base and you're thinking about, you know, sort of cloud networking, the challenges that folks who would listen to this podcast, you know, network engineers, or what do they really need to be thinking about in that sort of checklist order, or maybe the top 2-3 things that you're like, hey, this is the stuff I really need to be, you know, cognizant of, aware of, and keep top of mind when I'm thinking through this?
Well, I would say that the only thing they need to realize is that cloud networking is different. It's still IP. It still uses IP and MAC addresses and load balancing and all that stuff. So there's nothing new there. There's no magic. BGP is BGP, IPsec is IPsec. As we realized, you still need GRE if you want to run V6 over V4 IPsec.
Right.
You still need BGP if you want to peer and exchange routes. So all that stuff is the same. And anyone who tells you otherwise and who is trying to, you know, sell you unicorn farts, you know, vendors. On the other hand, networking inside the cloud is, in some aspects, fundamentally different from what people think networking should be based on their enterprise experience. Because, as you know, it's Ethernet everywhere and it's flooding everywhere and it's moving MAC addresses and moving IP addresses. And some vendors are proudly moving them across continents and they're so proud of it. And that simply doesn't work there because it doesn't scale. You cannot support this model at any decent scale, let alone the hyperscaler scale. So if you understand the first principles, if you understand how IP really works and why we're using MAC addresses, because, well, everyone wants to see an Ethernet NIC, doesn't work any other way, and why we use ARP and all that stuff, then very quickly, you know, you will figure out how things work and then you will realize what's going on and you'll be good. If, on the other hand, you think that you can just take your enterprise setup and just stretch it over into the public cloud, then you'll get the cloud deployment you deserve.
Right. So there's definitely a learning curve of learning how those best practice principles make a lot of sense to sort of take those cloud networking principles and make sure that you're doing the right thing within that cloud environment. It doesn't necessarily change about how your apps work or function or talk to each other. It's really understanding the principles about how they actually function within that cloud environment itself, right?
Well, from the app perspective, you know, there are no dirty tricks anymore.
Right.
So you can't push the problem down the stack until it lands in networking, because AWS and Azure just tell you no.
Yeah,
to solve the problem with load balancer or whatever else it is that you can use to solve the problem. You just can't, you know, push your problem down the stack and pretend it's not your problem anymore.
Right. So the high availability layer two stretching, you know, VLAN stretching scenarios that we typically in enterprise and data center to data center run into simply just sort of vanish on the AWS and Azure side of the equation. It's just like, respin that resource over there, put it in a different subnet and get your, you know, high availability and low balancer setups. Do it the way you're supposed to do it, which I do think is a good enforcement boundary.
Learn how to spell DNS.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and maybe that's a good outcome that comes from the adoption of more cloud networking, is to help those help sort of solve that application related problem, the sort of getting rid of that. Maybe that's one of the advantages we'll all see coming to our data centers, is like, okay, well, let's do it the same way we're doing it in public cloud. We'll do that on prem if we for any given reason.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Well, okay. Well, that's my wishful thinking.
See, a long time ago, I had an online consulting engagement with someone, and he wanted to move a database server from one data center to another. And they were migrating back from a public cloud for whatever reason. And I was like, excuse me, you had this beautiful application architecture, and you know, in public cloud there is no layer 2 migration and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you're going back to on-premises data center and you want to have long distance vMotion. What's wrong with you guys? And he's like, you know what, the application developers got used to having a single IP address that is redundantly implemented for the database server in the public cloud, so they stopped thinking about redundancy of the database server. Now that we're pulling the whole thing back into on-premises data center, I have to re-implement that redundancy.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. So I can see how this do you think a lot of folks are going to get caught in that sort of trap of like different sets of models in public cloud versus what they're doing on-prem, and this is going to bite them later? I sort of agree. I think this is one of the big great challenges, is that if you want to be, I guess if you're starting a new company, you're doing cloud first, it's not a big issue because you're just going to stay there and your principles are going to stay the same. But if you're trying to move back and forth, I think this is going to be something that's going to be a bigger challenge ongoing for many companies.
Oh, it will be the same thing if you try to move from Azure to AWS or whoever else. They're different.
All right. Well, is there any other limitations we should talk about? Cautions, concerns, cloud providers, anything that we should be, keeping a sharp eye out besides the network design side? Is there like, budget things, just don't use your own credit card? Like, I don't know. Yeah, go get the executive's credit card. If that runs up, you don't care. Although they earn all the miles and points. I guess that was one of the other things. That was a funny story I had. I was working with a startup and we were going in and talking to them. We're like, yeah, you really should get terms on your AWS spend. Go ahead and get someone to provide this as a purchase order for you and get signed up with AWS differently than what you're doing, because you're swiping your card. You're spending $150,000 a month. Like, and the executive came in and said, yeah, we're not changing that. He's like, why? He says, I make points on all of the spend that happens there. I'm taking my wife to some tropical location based off of the travel points I'm earning. We're not changing that. It was the weirdest conversation ever. So it's just sort of funny. I'm like, okay, cool. I guess we're doing credit card spend.
Well, what if it was the cashback credit card?
Yeah, cashback card. It's like,
the CFO might have something to say about that.
This guy was the CEO of the company. He's like, I don't care. I was like, wow, all right. It was pretty entertaining. I'm like, okay, that was a different conversation. But
what was that joke? If the founder is buying his socks and his cloud infrastructure with the same credit card, you have a problem.
Exactly. It's when it shows up and he's got all his DoorDash and Uber rides on the same card as the AWS spend. Yeah. Well, I think maybe we wrap with that sort of thought. I mean, I don't know if there's any other limitations or cautions you want to talk to, but it is sort of funny about how some of those behaviors do change for folks. And you do realize that, if there is a limit on your credit card and you hit that limit, they will turn the service off.
Yeah. Well, the only other thing is, it's not just a networking problem. You can't just expect to recreate your enterprise infrastructure in the public cloud and then just transport the applications over and life will be good. So everyone needs to be involved with this. Everyone needs to change the way they work. Everyone needs to adapt to the new environment. And if you do that, then yeah, you might have a chance of being successful. If not, well, you know, your CFO will have plenty of miles on his credit card.
Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for this podcast. Thanks to today's guest, Ivan Pepinac. Hey, how can I know lots of folks on Packet Pushers know how to follow you on the internet and probably already do, but let's talk about it. You've got some fantastic resources for folks, and you teach and provide training and education and just have some really great content out there. So how can folks get all of that?
Well, just go to ipspace.net and start exploring. There's a link to my blog. There are links to various webinars, including the networking webinars for Azure and AWS. We are running a two-day public cloud event next May, and registration will open in mid-January. Right now, there's a call for presentations out, and we already have some great guest speakers. We've heard from people who learned the hard way how hard it is to migrate to the public cloud, and I want to have some of them, you know, sharing their pains in the presentations in that event.
Yeah.
And if you just want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter or LinkedIn. And in both cases, I usually just publish the links to my blog posts there. And if someone sends me a reply, then we can engage in a conversation. Otherwise, you know, I just use them as a distribution mechanism because people forgot how to spell RSS.
And I can't recommend Ivan's courses enough. It's fantastic. I've sat in and participated in them, and just a wonderful resource for everyone who's trying to navigate their way through the networking landscape and specifically around cloud networking. It's been really good content. So, you know, congrats on that. That's really good. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz on Twitter at IPv6 Buzz. You can also hit up each one of us on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6 Tom, Scott is at Scott Hogue, and I'm at E Horley. Thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes, and hopefully you're listening on Spotify too. If you like the podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break, and all the other great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.